welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. That is
when will I be there? I don't know.
Singing on that, Laura Freeman. She has a new CD called Something Cool. She's appearing at the Acorn Theater next weekend. I'll tell you more about her, and you will hear more about her. But in studio with me is the great poet, saxophone player, publisher, teacher. What else are you, Al DeGenova?
What else am I? Everything.
Yeah, you got to be a lot. If you're going to be a working poet, you got to be a lot of different
things.
Yeah,
well, I work in marketing, you know. So I'm, you know, I started as a journalist and moved into, you know, public relations. So
You got smart.
You got smart.
Al and I go way back, and one of the things that he publishes is a bi-yearly publication called After Hours, which is a literary arts journal. How many issues so far?
Well, the current issue is number 29, so we're going on our 30th issue. So two a year, so it's 15 years now.
What's kept you alive in this weird... I mean, it is an ink-on-paper publication.
Yes,
and in this and in this weird publishing environment where things are falling by the wayside, what's kept you alive?
Well,
beside the quality of the...
well, you know, I mean, it's... Keeping us alive financially is, you know, support from good friends and, you know, readers and contributors and, you know, and myself. And, you know, it's a labor of love. You do it, you know, it's the kind of thing you do because you want to do it. And, you know, I have my co-editors, Pat Hertel, and she and I have worked together on this from the beginning. So.
Those of you who go to Printers Row Lit Fest have seen their little tent table. I call it a tent table.
Right, yeah.
Tell me about the initiation, the start of After Hours, will you?
Well, it goes back to, there's a couple of parallel stories there. Well, you know Charlie Rossiter and I.
Sure,
Charlie and
another
I were,
great poet.
We're running a reading series at the Buzz Cafe in Oak Park.
Mm-hmm.
We called it the Buzz After Hours. And Charlie and I decided after about a year that, you know, we had enough of doing that. And I said, you know, Charlie, I think I want to use that name. I'm thinking of, you know, putting together a literary magazine. And had a lot of encouragement from our friend Norbert Bly, who was a big supporter of Small Press.
Who we talk about here, yeah.
And I had edited the Oye Review at Roosevelt with my co-editor, Pat Hertel, when we were undergrads. And we stayed friends over the years. And I asked Pat, I said, you know, you want to do this? You know, and she said yes. So we... You know, and at that time, it was year 2000. I mean, the internet was around, but it's not the same as it is now. But I did a lot of emailing to people. But I really did a lot of self-promoting, going
sure.
to open mics
sure.
and passing out flyers to people.
And what did you find? Were you surprised by the quality of the responses you got?
Well, you know, I mean, when I started the magazine, I believed in Chicago writers, and I knew
yeah.
that there was a voice here in the city, so I wasn't really surprised. I knew it was there. And, you know, so our very first issue featured David Hernandez, who had been a longtime, you know, Chicago performance poet.
The late David Hernandez, who was once the city's poet laureate for a while, and a great... You know, there's a tradition in poetry of being almost kind of poet activists, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and David Hernandez was certainly
absolutely
one of those. And, yeah, you know, the poetry scene in Chicago is, you think about Mark Smith, and he's very
the man
much
who started the Green Mill and
right.
running it right now.
Yeah, right now, as
yeah.
we speak. But the there's so much poetry going on in Chicago, and you have to give a lot of credit to people like Mark Smith and David Hernandez. You know, David never stopped performing. Mark started the Slam. And, you know, so there's, you know, there's open mics almost every night of the week. You can hear poetry in the city.
It goes, doesn't it, to the human need to communicate, don't you think?
Yes.
Not to rarefy it too much, but that's basically it.
I think, no, that's absolutely true. And, you know, what poetry does is there's... You know, we have these basic human emotions that you can't learn in school, you can't learn in church, nobody can teach you, but so you read poetry to find out what loss feels like, to find out what love feels like.
You write it to express yourself
sure.
in this increasingly icy world we live in where, you know, a text message is, you know, X amount of letters.
Yeah, exactly.
Poetry can expand your own world.
Yeah, and it's also you keep... language alive, because that's, you know, the role of the poet is really to find new ways to use words, you know, metaphors, and, you know, and expand the language.
Do you think, Al DeGenova, who is a teacher as well, do you think one of the problems is the way poetry is taught in early education? It's like, here. And Joyce Kilmer wrote Trees. Recite this poem. Memorize this.
You know, that's actually changing. And it was terrible. But and because poetry didn't have the front stage like it does now, and there's more people coming to being English teachers who've grown up hearing performance poetry.
Because
you consider now the number of high schools that have performance poetry teams, spoken word teams. And
when you think of Kevin Koval and Louder Than a Bomb, which is spread like crazy, it goes to this human need for these kids.
And that's, you know, most poets that I know started writing when they were in high school. It's kind of that teenage angst kind of thing.
Well, you're not an old man, but at your time, writing poetry, it was sort of like, oh, maybe you'd write a poem to your girlfriend or something. It was not exactly thought of as a real
Express
yourself on the football field
Something. Exactly. Yeah. Nobody was really writing poetry in the 70s when I was in high school. But I was lucky enough, I had a great teacher at St. Ignatius who, in our AP English class, spent the whole semester on poetry.
And that's really what did it for you.
Yeah, and that's really where he forced us to analyze poetry, and I found how, poetry spoke to me. And I understood, how you could express emotions through poetry. And that's, that's what started me, really turned me onto it,
You have your own recently published collection, don't you?
Yes, I do. It's called A Good Hammer.
And how does that happen? The world of poetry has kind of expanded, the world of book publishing has gotten insane. Where unless your poems are all about vampires or something, it's probably hard to get published.
Well, the books that I have published are, published by publishers, so I'm glad to say that there was some editorial process. But the world of self-publishing has been made so easy by Amazon. You could go to Amazon and publish your own book, and they'll create e-books. So, I believe there's still a need for editors, but there is, as you said, there's an explosion of books out.
Don't you think there's a need for books, though? Books themselves.
Personally, yes. No one
who runs Amazon is listening to the show.
Well, they still sell a lot of books. Because I buy them. I know that they still sell paper books. The problem with poetry in the electronic format is a lot of poetry really depends on how it looks on a page.
No question.
And if poetry isn't presented correctly in the electronic format, it loses some of what the poet was intending, whether it's long lines, short lines, breaks, and then after hours, I try to never make a poem go to force you to turn a page. I like to see the poem on one spread or by itself, and rarely, we haven't had too many long poems that would go 3-4 pages. But
I'll bet you're a great, great teacher. When we come back after a short break, Al DiGenova and I will talk about teaching and one of the great teachers, the subject of one of your books, The Professor's Quarters. This is an after-hours publication.
It's our first real book, actually.
It is a first real book. That is a momentous occasion. We'll be right back.
The very thought of you and I forget to do the little old...
A local singer named Laura Freeman. Her new CD is Something Cool, and she's performing next Saturday at the Acorn Theater with Becky Menzie and Marianne Murphy Orland. Go to laurafreemansing.com and get all the information you want. Al DiGenova is in here, poet, teacher, saxophone player, a proud alumnus of St. Ignatius. And you decided good things can come of bad things. And the death of Norbert Bly was a bad thing on any level. Norb was only 77. One of the most gifted writers to ever appear in Chicago publications and elsewhere. But he abandoned Chicago years ago when the markets ran out. He didn't think they wanted the kinds of stories he told, which were stories about Studs Terkel and stories about Cicero and Berwyn and the places he lived. He once told me and told many people, he defined his life by saying, I am a storyteller, I am called to the page. He had an incredible influence on your life, didn't he, Al?
Yes, he did. And he was of course a writer through and through, but he was a consummate teacher. I mean,
yeah.
He had his own style of teaching, and he touched a lot of us. And when he passed, you know, there was, you know, a group of us were emailing and, you know, in mourning.
Sure, sure.
And we knew he had been sick, but it was still a shock. But Norb had been working on a book his working title was The Clearing Book. And
because that's where he worked.
He had taught at The Clearing for nearly 40 years.
40 years. The Clearing, one of the places founded by Jens Jensen.
That's right.
Famous architect.
Beautiful place, and that's where I met Norb, was at The Clearing. I met him, of course, first through his writing, through the first book I found of his is called Meditations on a Small Lake.
Yeah.
Wonderful book. And then I wrote him a letter. I said, you know, can I buy more of your books? Do you ever teach classes in Chicago? And he, in typical Norb way, said, you can order the books right from me, and here's a brochure about The Clearing.
Yeah.
And so it took me a year or two to get to The Clearing, but once I went, that was it.
Norb wrote 17 books, some that he published himself, but there are others. This famous trilogy, Chi-Town, Neighborhood, and The Ghost of Sandburg's Fizzog. If you can get them, get them. He also was a publisher. He had his Crossroads Press, which obviously influenced you too, Al, didn't it?
Right. He published my first book, which was co-authored with Charlie Rossiter.
Yeah.
It was called Backbeat. And, of course, that's a big deal to have your first book published. But that was his whole goal, was to publish first-time books. And
well, his goal, too, I knew Norb pretty well, but was never a student of his. His other mission was to empower, was it not?
Absolutely, because that was his teaching style.
Yeah.
He would guide you down the road, but you were your own writer, you were your own person. So you always had this sense of he didn't try to tell you what to say or how to say it.
Yeah, yeah.
He was just giving you the guidepost you need. Or, you know, he would do things. Before email, he would mail a clipping. He'd say, oh, here's something that might help you. And then started emailing things. Check this link out. Because he knew what you were working on. And
he nurtured.
An unbelievable reader, and so he would send these notes to you, and you'd just get them out of the blue, and they were exactly what you needed at exactly the right time.
I've got to believe when you put out the call for people to write about Norb for this potential book titled The Professor's Quarters, Teacher and Place, Inseparable, which is a very handsome book of remembrances of poems, of some artwork that you got, everybody saying absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I have to give credit where credit is due. The way it came about was Norb was working on this book, and he asked some of his students to write essays. And I was one of those students. And when he died, I wanted to share my essay. So I shared it with the core group of students. And then all the other people who he had asked to write started sharing theirs. And then, then it became obvious that this was pretty powerful stuff. And,
yeah, it's...
Then there was four of us core students, myself, Alice D'Alessio, Susan O'Leary, and, of course, Drew Genero, who had been Norb's partner at the end of his life for many years. And so the four of us started working on it, and, you know, we were able to put out the call. Jude, you know, had access to Norb's mailing list, and so she was able to get. So the, you know, it was a group effort, but I'm the official publisher, but everybody played a big role in putting
this book together.
But
it's also a tremendous, tremendous legacy.
Yes.
You know, you can see some, you know, people will comment online and some kind of online, well, more Norb was great and we loved him and everything.
Yeah.
There's a permanence to this that he would have. You know, he may have had some, hey, I didn't like that story. You know Norb, but...
Well, I think his personality, too, I don't know. He would have enjoyed the fact, you know, this outpouring of, you know, feeling for him, but I don't know how comfortable as he would have been with it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, but you people should get it, the Professor's Quarters. You can go to afterhourspress.com, and Courtney Crowder, the great producer, put all this information on the show's website. And then you can subscribe to After Hours, the bi-yearly publication, which is also worth your while. But the Professor's Quarters is just a lovely homage. It's the story of a guy.
Yeah. And a place.
And the place itself. You're teaching up there now, right?
Right, yeah. Norb and I were going to teach together. And, you know, we had met several times in planning the class. But then he, you know, his health really had a downturn. And, you know, one of our last meetings, he told me, he says, you know, I don't know, you might have to handle this yourself. Mm. And which, of course, I denied, and I said,
of
no,
course.
Norb, you're going to be there.
You're going to be there. Sure.
And but I did. I took his direction, started reading all the stuff that he was going to present, and then, of course, he passed. And then Susan O'Leary, who had worked with Norb for a number of years, contacted me. She said, "Do you want some help with the class?" And I said, "Yeah, of course."
Sure.
Because it's
kind of a lot
daunting
to take on. It's a lot to take
on.
Well,
Norb always had an assistant of some sort,
a co-teacher.
And so now I've taken over Norbert's class, which is what the book is about, his class. We're trying to carry on the tradition and the legacy, and Susan is, you know, is my partner in this. So the two of us have taken over the Norbert Blatt class.
I cannot imagine anybody better to take over that kind of thing.
That's quite a compliment.
I know it's a burden in some ways. I mean, Norb is always there, but I'm sure you're doing the best. You can learn more about this book, The Professor's Quarters, about After Hours Press by simply going to afterhourspress.com. And then you can explore Al. He is at albertdgenova.outlawpoetry, and you got to love that, .com. Al, it's great to see you. And,
you too.
You know, if you ever want money, I suppose you could sue WGN for the name of this show. I'm suing you for After Hours, except I did have a column called After Hours, we're bonded in so many ways.
Well, you know, the After Hours Press, in order to get the URL, they had to press.
I know. It's always great to see you, and this is a really remarkable book, The Professor's Quarters. Keep at it.
Okay.
Keep at it, my friend.
No stopping.
We'll take a little commercial break, then get some news, and then coming in here, the great director and filmer, the great actor Stan Klein, and a guy named Tony Fitzpatrick.